All right, we're right at 7 o'clock here, so we better get started.
I know, I was waiting for you to tell me.
I already feel like I'm making up for lost time. So, it's very good to be back. Holly and I have got this maxim that whenever you move someplace, usually whenever you take your first trip away from that place and then come back, that you have that feeling, now I've come back home. We definitely had that the other day when we came back. A week and a half is way too long. Thank you so much for your prayers while we were gone. Thanks for praying for my grandfather, praying for us while we were traveling. My grandpa passed a couple of Saturdays ago, but he was a faithful man. In fact, he was my role model for preaching. And it was him that got me interested in preaching. And he was, thankfully he's an easy man to eulogize. Whenever you're talking about somebody who's led a faithful life, that's an easy person to talk about. So I was honored to be able to do that, glad to be able to do that, and glad to be back home. Continue to keep my grandmother in your prayers. She is, I think, this would have been their 60th anniversary this year. And she's, she's a strong woman, but at the same time, God designed marriage to work in a certain way, right? Like a strong biblical marriage is not about self-sufficiency, right? It's not something where I could just if my spouse died tomorrow, wouldn't change anything. That's not the biblical picture that we get of marriage. And whenever you've been married for over 59 years, I don't know. My grandma, she's kind of in a daze right now, acting kind of lost. I've never seen her act that way before. So definitely keep her in your prayers. Her name's Mary Dalton. Keep Holly and Caroline in your prayers as well. They have had some sort of stomach issue going on. Maybe the stomach bug, maybe eating some bad Chinese chicken. We're not exactly sure what. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that it was Chinese chicken because I didn't eat it. but Carolyn's.
Is it Monday now?
Hmm?
Is it Monday?
So Holly had it on Monday when we were coming back. Caroline had it last night and this morning. And
sorry.
Yeah. Oh well. So I might be I might be out of commission. We'll pray. In fact, let's go ahead and pray before we jump into our text. Righteous Heavenly Father, thank you so much for the gifts that you have given us today. Thank you especially for our time together to study from your word. Thank you for the example that you've given us in your servants, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. As we read about them tonight and about their faith, help us, Father, to learn about how we are to live in the faith, and how we are to confront the difficulties that rise against us. Righteous Father, thank you for the gifts that you have given us in your Son. Help us, Father, to live faithful and righteous lives in him. Father, we lift up all of those who are sick and needy. And Father, I'm thinking especially of Holly and Caroline as they're recovering from their stomach illness. Father, I pray that you'll be with Peggy as she's recovering from bronchitis. And be with all of the others, Father, who are in need of your care. I pray that you continue to be with my grandmother. Father, again, we just thank you for the blessings that you've given us in your Son. And Father, we look forward to the hope that we have in the resurrection. In Jesus' name that we offer our prayer. Amen. All right, we are in Daniel chapter 3 tonight. So we're going to read through the whole chapter. Because these first six chapters, they're episodic. So each chapter is a story unto itself. So chapter 1 has a definite beginning, middle, and end. Chapter 2 has a definite beginning, middle, and end. And so does chapter 3. And all of these, they're going to be strung together for a purpose, but I want us to at least get this whole episode in one sitting in Daniel chapter 3 before we get down to the fine grain of the story. Daniel 3. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you on this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men that took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt, and the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and set aside the king's command, and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses laid in ruins. For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. All right, this is a pretty distinctive story. Right, and the way that Daniel tells it, a lot of things stick out in the memory of this story. And in fact, that's why this story is so popular as a Bible class story. And in fact, just coincidentally, the congregation where my parents worship up in Benton, Illinois, doesn't have really any little kids. And so my mom keeps some lessons prepared just in case they have little kids that come and visit. You know, something that is short that they can do in a single class period. And the one that she turns to more often than not, and in fact, the one that she went through with Caroline and Theoden when we were visiting that first Sunday, was the story of the burning fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because of the way that Daniel tells the story. But we're going to go through the text, and we're going to look at what Daniel is doing and why he says, why he presents this the way that he does. And as we go through, we're going to notice, like we said, this is a self-contained story here. This is an episode unto itself. And so it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, like any story. And we're going to move through the typical motion of the story. So we're going to begin by looking at the introductory matter of the story, the setup, which happens in the first seven verses. Then from there, we learn about a conflict. That's going to happen. Verses 8 to 18. This conflict is going to reach its climax and resolution over the course of verses 19 through 27. And then every story after the conflict is resolved, after the climax, has a falling action, something that we call a denouement. And that's going to be the last few verses of the chapter, verses 28 through 30. What happens as a result of this conflict being resolved in the way that it's resolved? All right, tonight, we're going to focus mainly on the first seven verses, the introduction to the story, because, first off, we're really familiar with the conflict and the climax, right? That's usually what we focus on, that this image has been set up, and everybody's been commanded to worship it. And the three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, refuse to worship. And this accusation is brought against them. Nebuchadnezzar confronts them with it, gives them a chance to bow down and worship. They refuse, and so they're bound and thrown into the fire, and they come back out alive. All right, we really focus on that part of the story. There are some things here in the first seven verses, some historical context, some cultural context that we really need to understand, I think, to get the most out of this story. So we're going to focus on that. So let's reread the first seven verses of chapter 3, just to have this immediately in front of us. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Like with the other chapters in this section, this introduction gives us the setting of the story. Unlike the other chapters, it does not give us a time. Remember, setting includes the time and the place where this takes place. So in Daniel chapter 1, we read that it's in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and that the action is taking place in between Judah and the land of Shinar, to the house of Babylon's gods. We talked about the meaning of Shinar, what that refers to. In chapter 2, it begins in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and we know that all of this is happening in the city of Babylon. In chapter 3, we don't get very much detail here. In fact, we get no time marker. It begins, "King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and its breadth 6 cubits." Now we do get a place, which we'll talk about more in just a second. He set it up on the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. All right, but we're not given a time here. It doesn't tell us when during the king's reign this is. That is a good question. As we're getting to understanding when this is and where this is going on, maybe we can arrive at an understanding of where Daniel is at in all of this. Let's start with this. First off, look at the empire. This map, most of this map, is covered by the Babylonian Empire at its height. All right, right now, this map is only labeled Babylon in this section right here that's kind of a faded salmon color. But at the height of Nebuchadnezzar's empire, the empire would stretch from roughly down here where the northern shore of the Persian Gulf meets the map. It would stretch up east of Susa, that's this city here, and it included all of this blue region labeled Assyria. So it would stretch along this mountain chain up here to the north, up to Armenia, and came all the way out east to this mountain range that's kind of obscured by the label here, and would have included everything up to the Mediterranean coast, including Syria, Israel, and Judah, and would have gone all the way down here. And there's this, if you're looking at the map, you can see this kind of little triangular area that is cut out mostly in white. That, as we noted a few weeks ago, is mostly desert, mostly waste. Different maps that you look at of the Babylonian Empire will include that territory in the empire. Some will not. But it's really because this was a no man's land. Nobody cared about this part of the map. But yeah, it's all desert. So Babylonia, the empire, stretches all the way along here. It would have covered an area, if you superimposed a map, or if you superimposed that over a map of the U.S., it would cover an area roughly the same size as like Montana plus the Dakotas, I think. Just to give you some sense of how big the empire is. Now, how do you rule an empire that's that big? All right, you don't have any of the modern means of communication or transportation. So what you rely on is everything is broken up into provinces, and every province has its officials. And they're in charge of that province, and they answer to the king. And in fact, in a lot of cases, and this was the case with Judah, sometimes the empire would leave the king in place or would install a king, even from the dynasty, the family that had ruled that country before the empire took over. And that king would just be answerable to the main king of the empire. So in this case, King Zedekiah of Judah would be answerable to King Nebuchadnezzar. That's how you take care of an empire. One thing that gives us a hint as to when this happened is we know from Nebuchadnezzar's own chronicles that he had to put down a revolt, I think in about the 10th year of his reign, sometime around 594 BC. And after he puts down this rebellion, he does a lot of things that help him consolidate power. First off, he purges his army. So he gets rid of all of these commanders, all of these generals that he thinks have participated in this revolt. And he goes around and he collects tribute from all of his western provinces. So that would have included Judah, by the way. So all of this region over here, he collected tribute from them. And then he went on tour with his army and went around and visited all of those western provinces. And he does all of this to consolidate power. Now, as we're reading Daniel chapter 3, we get this sense that worshiping the golden image, worshiping this statue, is not just Nebuchadnezzar trying to impose some pagan religion on all of the people here. That the worship of this image is centered on loyalty to the king. That's a good question. It's likely not, because Babylonian kings were never, as far as we know, they were never deified. And if he wanted to be deified, to act as a god, well, he was there personally to receive worship. So if he wanted people to worship him, well, he was there. He didn't have to set up an image necessarily. Probably a pagan god. Now, it's interesting that the text doesn't tell us what god that is. We'll come back around to that in just a second. But notice what's going on in the story. Who has Nebuchadnezzar called together to worship here? He sent together the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces. We're not just talking about Joe Schmo, right? He's not collecting, you know, all of the people who live within the borders of his empire. We're talking about officials, people who serve in the government of the empire, the people who would be responsible for overseeing all of these provinces. They are the ones who were required to come and worship this golden image that Nebuchadnezzar sets up. Notice, after the worship happens, in verse 8, notice the way the accusation is brought to Nebuchadnezzar. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree." By the way, notice, at every point in this story, the emphasis is on King Nebuchadnezzar. "You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you've appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you." Notice the way that they frame that accusation. It's not these guys are infidels who worship some foreign god, you know, unlike the rest of us. We all serve, you know, Marduk and Nabu, right? That's not the way they frame it. They frame it all in terms of what King Nebuchadnezzar has commanded. And the accusation is, "These men, O king, pay no attention to you." And it's only secondary that they do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Right, it's not primarily that they don't worship the gods. It's they're not worshiping the gods as evidence that they're not listening to you. That's the important thing here, is listening to the king. And that's what makes Nebuchadnezzar furious. That's his reaction in both instances, is that he's furious. Not that he thinks that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are infidels, but that they're not listening to him. And so it's likely, at least it's not unlikely, that this takes place sometime after that revolt that Nebuchadnezzar had put down. Because remember, he's going on tour, and he's consolidating power. He's requiring tribute, and we know that he also requires the heads of these provinces to come report to him. It would take some time to gather everybody in. Not necessarily years. It could be done in weeks or months. We know from the end of Jeremiah 51, and we're not going to read through that right now, we know that King Zedekiah made a trip to Babylon basically for this purpose, that he was required to appear before the king. So, knowing that the assembly included who it included, knowing that this event had happened, more than likely that's when this is taking place. Now, the where, it seems like the text has at least given us that, right? It says he set it up in the plain of Dura. The problem with that is that we do not know of any place in antiquity called Dura. That's not necessarily a problem. Obviously, there's lots of stuff that we've not discovered yet from the ancient world. But a lot of the big stuff, particularly in big empires like the Babylonian Empire, powerful ones that made stuff to last, we usually have a pretty good sense for where things are. So what's going on with Dura? One thing that's been suggested is that the word that's translated Dura here, or more likely transliterated Dura, could be borrowed, that word could be borrowed from Akkadian, and it could mean the cleft of a wall, or a niche in the wall. So it might signify that what Nebuchadnezzar has done is that he's built the statue in some cleft or niche up against the outer wall of the city. And so the people assembling would assemble on the plain outside of the city to bow to the statue. Right. So, but it would, it would have it taking place in Babylon, just outside the city walls, so shortly after the time that Nebuchadnezzar has put down this revolt. Now, what this has to do with Daniel and with the gods, let's try to go ahead and make that connection. And make some sense of why we're including some of these details and why Scripture tells us it's in the plain of Dura. Let's consider the statue itself. The statue, as we said, is likely not Nebuchadnezzar, because Babylonian kings were not deified. It could be Nabu. Nebuchadnezzar is named after Nabu. It could be Bel-Marduk, the central god of the Babylonian pantheon. But here's the important thing. The text doesn't tell us what this image depicts for various reasons that I hope to get to tonight. The text does not tell us who is or what is depicted by the image. And it doesn't tell us a lot of other things either. It doesn't tell us specifically who is in this assembly other than Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It doesn't tell us anything about Daniel. It doesn't tell us anything about King Zedekiah. We'll get to the potential meaning of all of that in just a moment. But let's look at the statue itself. The dimensions on this statue, or rather the proportions on this statue, are really, really odd. You look at the measurements again. 60 cubits high by 6 cubits wide. All right, now usually, the image that we get in our heads and the images that we use in Sunday school classes for this statue. The statue is depicting, you know, a god or a man, you know, something with arms and legs. It looks roughly human, right? How many of us are 10 times taller than we are wide? Right? I wish I was narrower, but I'm nowhere. You know, no human being normally is 10 times taller than they are wide. In fact, let me give you some sense of what this image would have looked like. If we start with, let's say that we've got a little guy that, so there's his head, there's his body. We'll just make a kind of a fat stick figure here. All right, there's our little worshiper right there. Little worshiper guy. And that's, let's say that that equates to roughly a 6 foot tall person. Here's what the image would look like. It would be about that tall, but only about that wide. So, what on earth does this image depict? Yeah, Yao Ming. Yeah, so you've got your little worshiper guy here, and here is the image, at least according to the proportions that are set out in the text there. So what's going on here? Do we just have some ridiculously elongated figure with, you know, a face that's like this long and a body that looks kind of like this? And just really long, thin legs and arms. Well, that, you see, that's a good question. Because that little detail about it being in the plain of Dura, this is why people speculate that Dura is a niche in the wall. Yeah, because we know that the wall around the city of Babylon was close to 300 feet high. All right, 60 cubits... is somewhere in the neighborhood of 90 to 100 feet tall, which means that it could be that this thing was so distended, you know, out of proportion that, yeah, normally you would have a hard time standing it up unless you leaned it up against the outer wall of the city. That's what leads a lot of people to think that it could that could be what's going on, that the wall is much, much bigger than this. So do we have a statue that's really distended? Possibly. Another possibility is that instead of having a gigantic figure that its feet start down at the bottom and its head go all the way up to the top, it could be that you've got a pedestal. So all of this area down here would be pedestal. And the statue itself would be, you know, up on the top. Because... remember, you've got all of these little people out on the plain in front of the image. And you can fit in a lot of people. And here's the point. This is built to be seen from a long ways off. To be seen potentially by a lot of people. It could be, yeah, you've got a little guy up at the top, on top of some massive pedestal. It could be that there's some ridiculously distended image. We're not told... but this is what we do know about it. That there's a massive assembly of government officials in front of it, and that it is very, very tall.
Oh. I...
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that is one thing that's going on here, is the text... you'll notice by leaving out a lot of details, the text is drawing our attention to a particular conflict that's going on. And the conflict is not necessarily between the God of Israel and Bel Marduk. The contest is not between the God of Israel and, Nabu. The contest here, if you had to name the two contestants in this chapter... one of them is definitely the God of Israel. Who's fighting against the God of Israel in this chapter? Yeah, King Nebuchadnezzar. And in fact, the text brings our attention to him repeatedly. In fact, the first words of the chapter, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold. Everything, and that continues throughout the chapter, by the way. Notice how often the text comes back around to that detail. So King Nebuchadnezzar sent. There's a dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Everyone gathered for the dedication of the image that the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. They stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Part of the herald's proclamation is that they are to worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And the very last thing that we read in the introduction, those first seven verses, is that everybody fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You never hear about the image without hearing Nebuchadnezzar's name in this chapter. It's all centered on Nebuchadnezzar. There's a connection. I want us to save that for just a minute. Because I want us to get to the reason why Daniel writes the way that he does in this chapter. Because there are some very peculiar things stylistically going on in this chapter. Yeah. To wrap up this little bit, what the statue looks like, but particularly what the statue represents, why Nebuchadnezzar has set up. We're uncertain about the precise setting. We don't know when this happened. We can give a good guess. We don't know exactly where it happened. Again, we can take a good guess. But there is definitely some political angle to this statue. As we've noted, there's an emphasis on the king throughout all of this. The accusation that's brought against the three friends is about whether or not they listen to the king. One of the things that you need to know is that in the ancient Near East, in places like Babylon, in places like Assyria, in the Medo-Persian Empire, in almost all of these cultures in the ancient Near East, kings were believed to rule on behalf of the patron gods of the state. So the king represents God. All right. Now, in some cases, like in Egypt, technically not part of the ancient Near East, but Egypt, Pharaoh was considered to be a god. In most of these other places, the king is not considered to be God, but he represents God. So, venerating this statue, worshiping the statue, was not just an expression of worship. Right? The separation of church and state that we have was not a thing back then. If you were worshiping the statue, that expressed your loyalty to the king. Well, that's why he sets it up. He wants it to be an impressive spectacle. All right, and people being impressed at this statue, they're not going to just be impressed at Nabu or Bel-Marduk or whoever's depicted on the statue. They're going to be impressed with Nebuchadnezzar because he's the one who set it up. I mean, haven't we been told 500,000 times? He's the one that set it up. It's made out of gold. So it's at least, it's probably not solid gold, but it's at least plated with gold. So it's impressive, and all of that glory comes back on the king. And now this is one of the reasons, more than likely, why the text doesn't bother to tell us what the statue depicted. Right? Because, again, Daniel wants our attention squarely on Nebuchadnezzar. Excuse me. Now, there's one other thing that's going on here with this statue. Notice one of the phrases that's repeated, and there are many repeated phrases in this chapter, but one of the repeated phrases is peoples, nations, and languages. In other words, all of these government officials that are assembled on the plain before the statue, they represent people from across the empire, not just Chaldeans, but Assyrians and Jews and Syrians and all other sorts of people that you can see represented on the map there. Lots of different languages. I want us to remember Daniel identifies this place by a different name in chapter 1. We said Shinar. Now remember what that represents. That takes us back to, you know, Genesis chapter 10, Genesis chapter 11, and the Tower of Babel. And one of the emphases in that story is how everybody was unified in language. And remember what Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. Again, even if this doesn't necessarily take place after that revolt, what's going on here by gathering all of these people from across the empire, referring to all peoples, nations, languages, and making them engage in the same worship, that Nebuchadnezzar is trying to unify his empire around the worship of this statue. He is consolidating power. All right? It's not just that he's interested in the glory of the god being spread throughout the empire. He's mainly interested in his glory being spread throughout the empire, loyalty to him being spread throughout the empire. Yeah, making sure that his power is consolidated. Because, anyway, just brief historical note, the Assyrian Empire that ruled before the Babylonian Empire, in fact, they had even ruled Babylon at one point, the Assyrian Empire spirals out of control, like all empires do. And ultimately, what happens to all empires is that they cover such a big area that they can't properly control it all. You know, you've got people that are vastly different, you know, over the area that the empire covers. People that are very, very different from each other, and it is very difficult to keep control of that many people. Not just the sheer number, but the variety of people. So this text, and we've noted this before. This text is inviting us to consider this as a contest between the God of Israel and the man behind the statue, Nebuchadnezzar. There are a few things that I want us to notice here as for this contest. The word that's used for dedication here in these first seven verses, so they're all called to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The word that's used for dedication here is also used for the dedication of the altar in Numbers chapter 7. In other words, we're supposed to make this connection. There's a contest going on between the faith of Israel and what Nebuchadnezzar's calling them to. The text also repeats the three friends' Babylonian names. Like, this is why we know them as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's not their names, right? It's Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. But chapter 3 here bludgeons us over the head with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over and over and over. It's like 30-some-odd times that you hear those three names over the course of this chapter. To emphasize their position, their place in the empire, the friends are expected to act like pagans in accordance with the pagan names that have been imposed on them by their pagan captors. We're constantly being reminded, the three friends, you're supposed to be pagans now. You're supposed to be like the rest of us. Fall down and worship. All right, that's the way that this contest is couched. And so for us, this is a pretty clear contest between Nebuchadnezzar's commandment to fall down and worship and the first commandment of the Ten Commandments, you shall have no other God before me. All right, that's what's going on here. And that's the way that the text sets this up. Now, the end of this passage, verses 1 through 7, tells us that the assembly, by and large, obeys Nebuchadnezzar. This obedience that we read about, as soon as everybody heard the sounds of all these instruments, they fell down and worshipped. As far as this text is concerned, the obedience is universal and immediate. They hear the music, they fall down and worship. And so, as it has happened earlier in the book, it seems like at this point Nebuchadnezzar has gotten his wish. Right? He wants everybody unified. He wants everybody together. He wants everybody to listen to what he says and to do it. And it looks like that has happened. Yeah. Go for it. Now, Nebuchadnezzar tells us that it looks like a son of God, that it's an angel. That's all the evidence that we have. That's something that's been a point of contention historically. Is it an angel? Some people have speculated that it's the second person of the Trinity, Jesus himself, in there in the furnace with them. The text doesn't tell us exactly. Yeah, but Nebuchadnezzar does see that there is a fourth person in there who looks like a son of the God. So it's clear that this deliverance is divine. And that the divine force that is saving Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is going in there with them to deliver them. And that's where the connection to Jesus typically comes in our interpretation, that Jesus enters into the physical world to save us from sin. He doesn't just save us from on high, but he goes into the furnace with us, so to speak. That's what Nebuchadnezzar says. Yeah. So that, again, you know, we could take Nebuchadnezzar at his word. We have to remember that Nebuchadnezzar is a pagan. So maybe he saw an angel. Who knows? Exactly. All right, so we've had the second bell. We've got to wrap it up there. The conflict and the resolution move much more quickly. On Sunday, I want us to begin with... And let me just leave you this one last note. Does it strike you as odd or funny how wordy and repetitive this chapter is? Yes, definitely annoyingly so. Daniel... Mm-hmm. Yes, and that gets us to the question that Mary had asked earlier that I didn't really get around to, is where's Daniel in all of this? Hope to answer that beginning Sunday. But I want us to, before we talk about that, I want us to talk about why Daniel is writing this the way that he writes it. It's not that Daniel is a bad writer. Right, Daniel's doing this for a particular reason. And I want us to explore what that reason is on Sunday. All right, thank you so much for your attention and your comments. And Lord willing, we'll wrap this up on Sunday.